From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This hour, science versus religion. I'm Jim Fleming. Ever since the Catholic Church condemned Galileo for his revolutionary findings about the Earth's orbit around the sun, science and religion have had a difficult relationship. More recently, that tension has boiled over in the debate over evolution and creationism. But do science and religion have to be at war? Francis Collins doesn't think so. As head of the Human Genome Project, he's one of America's most visible scientists. He's also an evangelical Christian.
Science investigates the natural world. If God has any meaning at all, God is outside of the natural world, and so it is completely a misuse of the tools of science to try to apply them to this discussion.
Today we'll talk with Francis Collins and with writer Rebecca Goldstein, who's out to reclaim the 17th century philosopher Spinoza as a modern-day hero.
For the pursuit of truth, we have the faculty of reason, and that is an arduous, difficult endeavor to come to truth. And religion is just not about that.
As for science versus religion, I'm issuing a restraining order. Religion must stay 500 yards from science at all times.
Well, if we did that, we wouldn't have much to talk about. Now, I should say our executive producer, Steve Paulson, has plenty of questions about religion and science. As a recent Templeton Cambridge Journalism Fellow in Science and Religion, Steve has immersed himself in this subject.
Getting a handle on the charged relationship between science and religion is not easy. Emotions tend to run high. Some people even go so far as saying science and religion are irreconcilable. To get a sense of the range of opinion, I talked with four major figures in the science and religion debate: Edward O. Wilson, Karen Armstrong, Richard Dawkins, and Ken Wilber. First, the great entomologist E.O. Wilson, the founder of sociobiology.
Of course, there is no reconciliation between the theory of evolution by natural selection and traditional religious view of the origin of the human mind.
Now, this is not a view that all scientists subscribe to. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould famously talked about how he considered science and religion to be two entirely separate spheres, and they really didn't have anything to do with each other.
Yeah, he threw in the towel.
He dodged the question.
He dodged the question famously. You know, that's no answer at all. That's just evasion.
What about the sense of awe, of wonder? Certainly, that's something you hear about all the time among religious people, and you also hear about it from some scientists as well.
Well, you do. You'll hear about it from me. Awe is, that's a hard one to put exactly into words, but it certainly involves a sense of sublimity, there's another word, and a sense of the mightiness and the splendor of something greater than ourselves. The story of the origin of life on this planet, the time scale, the complexity of how it's put together, all of that together engenders in me probably even more awe than I ever felt as a devout young Southern Baptist growing up.
Let me ask you about that. You grew up religious, in a religious family.
Oh, yes. I grew up fundamentalist.
Fundamentalist?
Oh, yes. I grew up as a Southern Baptist with strict adherence to the Bible, which I read as a youngster. And I grew up in a tradition in Alabama in which I was warned by counselors that the truth was in the Bible, redemption was only in Christ, and that the world is full of satanic force. Satan himself, perhaps, is certainly his agents who would try to make me drop my belief. But no matter how lucid they sounded, I was told, no matter how compelling, no matter how smart they were, I was to say, in effect, you know, turn from me, thou Satan. And I had that instilled in me. You have to understand how powerful religious drive, the instinct, which I consider tribalist, but probably necessary in most societies for continuing day-to-day business.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I mean, basically, yeah, you're saying it's necessary, but it's wrong.
Well, you see, in a way, that's the dilemma of the 21st century. That's possibly the greatest philosophical question of the 21st century, is the resolution of religious faith with a growing realization of a very different nature of the material world. You could say that we evolved to accept one truth, you know, mm-hmm. the religious instinct, but then discovered another. And having discovered another, what are we to do?
That's evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson.
Scientists, I am sure, would say that they can explain a tremendous amount, but they can't talk about meaning.
Karen Armstrong is an acclaimed historian of religion and author of A History of God and many other books.
If your child dies, or you witness a terrible natural catastrophe such as Hurricane Katrina, and you've lost, you know, you see the destruction of life and property, you want to have a scientific explanation of it. But that's not all human beings need. We are beings that fall very easily into despair because we're meaning-seeking creatures. And if things don't add up in some way, we can become crippled by our despondency.
So would you say that religion addresses those questions of meaning through the stories, through
yes.
through the myths?
Yes. In the pre-modern world, there were two ways of arriving at truth. Plato, for example, called them mythos and logos, myth and reason or science. And we've always needed the two. We need both of them.
Well, what do you say to those people, the scientists out there, and I'm thinking especially of the evolutionary biologists, the Darwinists, Richard mm-hmm. Dawkins would be the obvious case, who are quite angry about religion. They mm-hmm. say religion is the root of much evil in the world, that wars are fought, are fueled by religion. And they say, you know, we don't need that anymore. It's getting in our way, and we can be perfectly ethical people without religion, and it's time, in the 21st century, it's time that science replace religion.
Well, I don't think it will. We've seen in the scientific age, we've seen a massive religious revival everywhere but Europe. And some of these people, not all by any means, but some of them seem to me to be secular fundamentalists. And they have as bigoted a view of religion as some religious fundamentalists have of secularism. If your beliefs make you compassionate, empathic with others, willing to be unselfish, then that is great. If, however, our beliefs, whether they be extremely religious or if they be radically secular, make us intolerant, unkind to other people, and blinkered, saying, I alone am right and everybody else is wrong, then this, I don't think, is a good belief. We've got too much dogmatism mm-hmm. at the moment, too much certainty. Let's not forget that in its short history, secularism has had some catastrophes.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly most of the tragedies of the 20th century were committed by secularists. Stalin, Hitler.
Saddam Hussein, another question in point, a secularist supported by us in the West initially for 10 years. Even when he gassed the Kurds, we supported him because he was a secularist. And if people are resistant to secularism in Iraq now, it's because their most recent experience of it was Saddam. So I think this kind of chauvinism that says science is right, religion is wrong, or secularism is right, religion is all bomb, this is one-sided and I think basically egotistic.
Historian of religion, Karen Armstrong.
I think that religious belief is a scientific belief in the sense that it makes claims about the universe which are essentially scientific claims.
Richard Dawkins is a biologist, author of The Selfish Gene, and probably the world's best-known atheist.
Miracles. If you believe in miracles, then that's clearly a scientific claim, and scientific methods would be used to evaluate any miracle that somebody claimed evidence for.
What about the old adage that science deals with the how questions and religion deals with the why questions?
Yes, I think that's remarkably stupid, if I may say so. What on earth is a why question? there are why questions that mean something in a Darwinian world. We say, why do birds have wings to fly with? They don't mean that, though. They mean why in a sort of deliberate, purposeful sense. Those of us who don't believe in religion, supernatural religion, would say there is no such thing as a why question in that sense. Now, the mere fact that you can frame an English sentence beginning with the word why does not mean that that English sentence deserves or should receive an answer. I could say, why are unicorns hollow? That's a perfectly good English sentence. It appears to mean something, but you don't think that it deserves an answer.
But it seems to me that the big why questions are, why are we here? And what is our purpose in life? Okay, that's a what question, but it's basically a why question.
And that's right. It is a why question, but it's not a question that deserves an answer.
Well, but I think most people would say those questions which are central to the way most people think about their lives. I mean, those are the big existential questions, but those are also questions that are beyond science.
If you mean what is the purpose of the existence of the universe, then I'm saying that that is quite simply begging the question. If you happen to be religious, you think that's a meaningful question. Those of us who don't believe in a God will say that is as illegitimate as the question, why are unicorns hollow? It just shouldn't be put. It's not a proper question to put. It doesn't deserve an answer.
I guess I don't understand that. I mean, doesn't every person wonder about that? I mean, isn't that just sort of this core question of what are we doing in this world? Doesn't everyone struggle with that?
There are core questions. There are core questions like, how did the universe begin? Where do the laws of physics come from? Where does life come from? Why, after some period of billions of years, did life originate on this planet and then start evolving? Those are all perfectly legitimate questions to which science can give answers. If not now, then we hope in the future. There may be some very, very deep questions, perhaps even where do the laws of physics come from, that science will never answer. That is perfectly possible. I'm hopeful, as along with some physicists, that science will one day answer that question. But even if they don't, even if there are some supremely deep questions to which science can never answer, what on earth makes you think that religion can answer those questions?
I'm not saying that religion can answer, but I guess my point is that people still ask those questions, and as you've very articulately said, they seem to be beyond the purview of science, but aren't they still legitimate questions to ask about, even if you can't get any definitive answer?
Well, a legitimate question is, where do the laws of physics come from? An illegitimate question, in my view, is, what is the purpose of the laws of physics? Because what is the purpose of the laws of physics implies that there's some kind of deliberate purpose giver or purpose thinker, which begs the question we're trying to answer, which is there a God?
That's biologist and atheist Richard Dawkins.
The problem, of course, depends entirely on what you mean by science or what you mean by religion.
Ken Wilber is a leading philosopher of consciousness. His many books include The Marriage of Sense and Soul, Integrating Science and Religion.
If you don't know what you mean by science, you don't know what you mean by religion, then you really don't know what you mean by science or religion.
Well, a lot of people would say that science over the last few centuries has steadily dismantled the myths of religion, and by now it has basically replaced religion as a way of understanding the world. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, there are at a minimum two types of religion. And one is indeed a kind of a mythic dogma, a magic mythic approach. And that is certainly what most people mean by religion. It's the most prevalent. But virtually all of the great traditions themselves recognize the difference between what they would call exoteric, outer religion, and esoteric, inner religion. And the inner religion tends to be contemplative or meditative. They're ways of working with the mind and disciplining the mind. And if you look at those, it's an entirely different story. Science has pretty thoroughly dismantled the mythic dogmatic religions. But in terms of the contemplative traditions, science is actually very, very sympathetic with those in terms of its actual methodology.
There's no denying that science has been extremely successful at explaining the material world. And the whole Enlightenment project, rejecting the church as the dominant intellectual and moral authority, where did the scientific worldview overreach?
Well, the mythic approaches tend to be pre-rational or pre-conventional and so on. But aspects of the contemplative approaches tend to be trans-rational. They completely accept rationality, they completely accept science as far as it goes. But they point out that there are higher or deeper modes of awareness that are in their own way scientific. And what conventional science has done is correctly work with dismantling the pre-rational myths, but incorrectly going too far and dismantling the transrational because they can't tell the difference between pre and trans.
When you talk about pre-rational myths, I mean, you're talking about most of the stories we would read in the Bible, for instance.
You bet. Or any of the world's great. I mean, Lao Tzu was 900 years old when he was born, and according to the Hindus, the earth is resting on a serpent, which is resting on an elephant, which is resting on a turtle. Yeah, those kind of mythic, dogmatic approaches are not really wrong. They're a stage of development. Now, I turned to Zen Buddhism originally because, to me, it was very scientific. You have to sit and train the mind. You have to be able to concentrate on an object for at least 5 minutes, often much more, but at least 5 minutes without losing track. The average adult American can do it for 18 seconds. The data there is called Satori. You look in your mind stream, once you've trained it, and you investigate your interior consciousness. And if you do this intensely enough, you get a profound aha experience, a profound Satori, a profound awakening. And then that Satori or experience is then checked with others who have done it.
But I'm guessing that most scientists would not accept that as proof of this as science. I mean, because ultimately you're left to people describing their own experiences.
Yes.
I mean, you can't measure this with any conventional scientific instruments.
You move in the realm of what's called phenomenology. And you're of the mindset that you either allow phenomenology or you don't. And this applies to anything like psychoanalysis, same stuff. Same complaints are brought against that. It's not real science. It's not real. You can't prove it. Well, fine. I mean, if that's so, you can't prove any interior experience you're having. So you can't prove you love your wife. You can't prove that you're happy. You can't prove that you have an insight. You forget all of that. It's not real. And if that's the mindset you have, nobody's going to convince you otherwise.
Philosopher Ken Wilber talking with Steve Paulson. Steve also spoke with E.O. Wilson, Karen Armstrong, and Richard Dawkins.
You see, there's a chemical in our bodies that makes it so that we all get on each other's nerves sooner or later.
Hey, that's science. I don't believe in science. I'm science is an intellectual dead end. You know, it's a lot of little guys in tweed suits cutting up frogs on foundation grants. And
oh, I see. You don't believe in science. And you also don't believe the political systems work. And you don't believe in God, huh?
Right.
So then, what do you believe in?
Sex and death. Two things that come once in my lifetime. But at least after death, you're not nauseous.
A scene from the Woody Allen film Sleeper. Want more on the debate over science and religion? Go to our website at ttbook.org/god. And while you're there, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, how today's neo-pagans are creating a new mystery tradition in the scientific age. Also, faith, reason, and Spinoza. And the head of the Human Genome Project, who is an evangelical Christian.
I would dare to say that God had a plan of creatures like us. Need they have looked exactly like us? Does in his image mean that God looks like us and has, you know, toenails and a belly button?
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Science versus Religion. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. Brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Say God created all things, so when you talk about scientists doing what they do, who created them to do that?
Religion and science are both things that we've thought up. I mean, if Newton hadn't discovered gravity, was it already there before?
I think they can coexist quite nicely.
I definitely think science is more important because having this blind belief in God isn't really going to help us deal with the problems that we have.
We've created science to understand our world, and we've created religion to help us deal with our world.
I believe that the Lord allows us to acquire knowledge, And it's important to keep in mind that we're finite creatures. People think that we're human beings trying to have a spiritual experience, but we're really spiritual creatures trying to have a human experience.
The worst part about religion is when it gets away from being human. And one of the essences of being human for me is I'm utterly delighted when I can sit and ponder the same question between a spiritual aspect and a scientific aspect.
And I think that some of the best scientists have been very religious people, really been guided by their faith.
The Word of God confirms a lot of science, and scientists think they've found something great, but God has created it before they figured it out, and they're only seeing the marvelous works of God.
Religion is just a salve for people who are not able to find the truth in the things that they can actually experience on the planet.
Science and religion, for me, on a daily basis, I do the Sudoku.
When Einstein was asked if he believed in God, he said he believed in Spinoza's God. Bertrand Russell called Spinoza the noblest and most lovable of the great philosophers. More recently, the neurologist Antonio Damasio made Spinoza a central figure in his theory about emotion and consciousness. So what's all the fuss about this 17th century philosopher? Well, Baruch Spinoza was a man far ahead of his time. Though he grew up among Orthodox Jews, he believed in the power of reason above all else, which got him branded a heretic. Spinoza is now the subject of a book by the novelist and philosopher Rebecca Goldstein. It's called Betraying Spinoza.
Spinoza himself never called himself an atheist. He was soundly denounced throughout 17th century Europe. He was first excommunicated from his community of birth, the Jewish community of Amsterdam. He was excommunicated at the age of 23, and nobody in that community was allowed to read him. So he was denounced as an atheist, one, because, you know, he didn't believe in a transcendent God. God is immanent within nature. He meant by nature something quite different from, you know, trees and rivers. And also he thought that we could deduce purely through the faculty of reason how we ought to live, how we ought to treat one another. And so we don't need to have any recourse to a supernatural authority. There's no authority but us in this world, but that's sufficient.
The essential sin, if sin it is, that he seems to have committed is to deny the necessity of faith.
Yes, he denies the necessity of faith. In fact, in his system, not only is it unnecessary, it's unethical. To believe in the absence of reasons, to make that leap of faith, to say, you know, I believe despite all in the face of evidence, to him, this is a violation of our human responsibility to ground all of our beliefs as best we can. So for him, faith is not only not necessary, it's downright immoral.
In the book that you've written, this is especially startling for you, I gather, because you were raised in strict teaching to believe in the necessity of faith. How did you first come across Spinoza?
Yes, well, I had the great fortune, I suppose, to grow up in a community that bore some striking similarities to Spinoza's own community. I grew up also in a quite insular religious community, Orthodox Judaism, and also a community, many of the members of which had been traumatized by a Jewish catastrophe. In Spinoza's case, it was the Portuguese-Spanish Inquisition. His community was mostly composed of refugees from that still ongoing horrific experiment in intolerance. And I grew up in a community, the remnants of a once flourishing family in Hungary, who had also been decimated by that horrific experiment in intolerance in Nazi Germany. And I went to a school that was very, very Orthodox, and I first heard of Spinoza in a course in Jewish history in which he was set out as an example of what can go so terribly wrong if one uses one's reason to question the basic tenets of religion. So he was really set out as a kind of cautionary tale against the arrogance of reason, and I was hooked.
For an outsider looking at this, of course, it sounds as though any teenager would have been fascinated by a man of such great intellect who was also a great rebel. Now, that can't have been true for everyone because the teacher was clearly using this in the expectation that it would drive you away from Spinoza forever.
Yeah, no, it's true. And mind you, this was a time of great rebelliousness. It was the late 60s, and here we were in, you know, an all-girls school with our skirts down to our ankles, and the teachers had their hands full. But the great adventure of pure reason that led him outside of his community and that caused him to have a very difficult life, I guess to many, many of the students in that school, didn't sound terribly appealing, but it did to me.
Led him outside of his community, you said. In fact, he was excommunicated and barred from even speaking to anyone in his community. Is that right?
That's right. The writ of excommunication is very, very strong. He's cursed with every curse in Deuteronomy, and everybody in the community is exhorted to have nothing to do with him. He was, at that time, in business with his younger brother, and, you know, his younger brother couldn't speak to him. Nobody in his family was allowed to speak to him. And he seemed to have accepted it all almost with a degree of satisfaction.
Well, and of course, you can consider it a blessing in a way, because had it not been so extreme, had he not been, as he put it, freed to think and say and write what he wanted to, we would not know the philosophy of Spinoza that we know today.
It's interesting to think, you know, could he have done the same sort of thinking so outside the bounds of anything that had come before? He is influenced, I should say, by the great French Catholic philosopher René Descartes. So it was, I shouldn't say it's unprecedented, and he did learn on his own. He's also influenced somewhat by Hobbes. So he did, once he left the community, he did become familiar with other scholars. He learned Latin. He wrote in Latin. But yes, I think if the hostility and the renunciation of his community hadn't been quite so bitter and final, maybe he could have made his peace with it, and the magnificent system never have seen the light of day.
He seems to have had a very complicated relationship with not just his family, but with his religion. There is a suggestion that he was definitely ostracized by Jews, but he clearly drew on Jewish thinkers. He respected the ideas, at least as beginning points, for the construction of his theories of philosophy.
Yes, it's true. I mean, I would tell my students that if you take Cartesianism, you know, the thinking of Descartes, and Kabbalah, which is the mystical tradition in Judaism, and you put them together, you get Spinoza. But this is clearly a simplification, but definitely there are seeds of Jewish thinking within Spinoza. And there's also, I think, emotionally, that the trauma that so surrounded him in that community had an impact on him. So the great issue of his life is religious intolerance and what should be the divide between religion and the pursuit of truth. He didn't think that religion really had anything to do with the pursuit of truth. It has its place. It's a way in which we can bond with our fellow, with people, form a community. It's a way in which we can mark the important passages of lifetime, you know, birth and death and coming of age, and all of these rituals are very important for this feeling of intimacy with one's community. But we should see it as celebrating the significance of our lives and not as the pursuit of truth. For the pursuit of truth, we have the faculty of reason, and that is an arduous, difficult endeavor to come to truth. And religion is just not about that, he says. And that was, for him, this would be a wonderful, if we would see this, this would free us from the power that religion has to make, you know, lives miserable. If one particular religion assumes that it knows exactly what it is that God is and what God wants from us, and woe be to anybody who doesn't believe the same, you know, the horrors that can follow. And he felt this, I think, in the marrow of his bones. How could he have not, having grown up in the community that had been so victimized by the Spanish-Portuguese Inquisition, and then victimized him?
Rebecca Goldstein. Her book is called Betraying Spinoza, the Renegade Jew Who Gave Us Modernity. As the longtime head of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins is one of America's most prominent scientists. He holds impeccable scientific credentials, a medical degree as well as a PhD in physics, and he has a distinguished track record as a gene hunter. He's also an evangelical Christian, someone who has no qualms about expressing his belief in miracles. In his book, The Language of God, Collins says there's no inherent conflict between science and religion. In fact, he's trying to stake out the middle ground between Darwinian atheists and religious fundamentalists. Steve Paulson talked with Collins about science and religion and his own conversion to Christianity.
You've said that you were once an obnoxious atheist. What changed you? Why did you turn to religion?
Well, first of all, I became an atheist because as a graduate student studying quantum mechanics, life seemed to me to be reducible to second-order differential equations. Mathematics, chemistry, and physics sort of had it all, and I didn't see any need to go beyond that. And frankly, I think I was at a point in my young life where it was convenient for me to not have to deal with a God or to be responsible to a God. I kind of liked being in charge myself. But then I went to medical school, and I watched people in my care who were suffering terrible diseases and yet who seemed to have this enormous strength about them that came from their faith. And one of my patients on a particular afternoon, after telling me about her faith and how it supported her through the terrible heart pain she was having, turned to me and said, "What about you? What do you believe?" And I stuttered and stammered and felt the color rise in my face and said, "Well, I don't think I believe in anything." But it suddenly seemed like a very thin answer, like I hadn't really given this enough thought. And that was unsettling. I was a scientist who was supposed to draw conclusions from the evidence, and I realized at that moment that I'd never really looked at the evidence for and against the possibility of God.
Well, in your book, you describe this as a thoroughly terrifying experience.
It was. It was like your worldview is suddenly under attack. But I didn't think I could just walk away from it. So I set about reading about the various major world religions and found them all very confusing. And so I went down the street and met with a Methodist minister in this little town in North Carolina and asked him a bunch of blasphemous questions. And he smiled and answered a few of them, but said, "You know, I think you'd learn a lot if you'd read this book on my shelf, because it was written by somebody who has traveled the same path." And the book was Mere Christianity by the Oxford scholar C.S. Lewis. And within the first three pages, I realized that my arguments against faith were those of a schoolboy.
Wow. So that one book totally changed your life.
Absolutely. As I turned the pages and read his arguments about the moral law, the knowledge of right and wrong, which is unique to human beings of all the organisms on the planet, and how that makes no sense from the perspective of basic evolution and biology, but it makes great sense as a signpost to God, I began to realize the truth of what he was saying.
Now, a lot of scientists say religious faith is irrational. Your fellow biologist, Richard Dawkins, calls it the great cop-out. How do you respond to these critics of religion?
Well, certainly this has been one of the more troubling developments in the last several decades, and many people trace it back to Darwin, of course. I think that commits an enormous act of hubris to be able to say, because we are now so wise about evolution and how life forms are related to each other, and that data, by the way, is absolutely rock solid, then we have no more need of God. Science investigates the natural world. If God has any meaning at all, God is outside of the natural world. And so it is completely a misuse of the tools of science to try to apply them to this discussion.
So God is outside of space and time?
I would say so. And God is certainly outside of nature. So for a scientist to say, "I know for sure there is no God," it seems to me commits a very serious logical fallacy. And frankly, I think many of the current battles that are going on between atheists on one side of the extreme of the spectrum and fundamentalists who insist on literal interpretations of Genesis, on the other, have really been started from the scientific community and based upon arguments that really don't hold water when you look at them carefully. This is an enormous tragedy of our present time that we have given the stage to the extremists.
Why do you say those arguments have started from the scientific end? Because some of these scientists, like Dawkins, have said that a theory like evolution leads to atheism?
I think that's been a very scary statement coming back towards the religious community, where people have felt they can't just leave that hanging in the air. There has to be a response. If you look at the history of the intelligent design movement, you will see that it was a direct response to claims coming from people like Dawkins that seemed to require a response from the religious community, that they could not leave this claim that evolution alone can explain all of life's complexity unchallenged, because it sounded like a godless outcome.
So one solution, one response then, is just to simply dismiss evolution, to say it doesn't hold up as science.
Right. And I think that's what many well-intentioned, sincere believers have done. The shelves of many evangelicals are full of books that point out the flaws in evolution, discuss it as only a theory, almost seem to imply there's a conspiracy here to avoid the fact that evolution is actually flawed. All of those books, unfortunately, are based upon conclusions that no reasonable biologist would now accept. Evolution is about as solid a theory as one will ever see. And if you believe in God, and if you believe that God is the author of all truth, then the one thing we must not do is to try to defend him by telling a lie. My God is bigger than that. He didn't design evolution so that it had flaws and had to be fixed all the way along the way. My God is this amazing creator who, at the very moment that the Big Bang occurred, already had designed how evolution would come into place to result in this marvelous diversity of living things and ultimately special creatures in his image with whom he could have fellowship, created through the mechanism of evolution, but not a random process to him who's above space and time, knew the outcome. And here we are.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out if you think that God intervenes in the affairs of human beings, because virtually all of your argument so far is no, God stays out of that realm of humanity.
I think God can intervene. I think that's what the great miracles are. Certainly God intervened in the person of Jesus Christ and in the most amazing miracle of all, of the resurrection. But I don't think God sort of pops up in lots of circumstances and turns around the course of events or alters the way in which nature is going to behave. I think those are reserved for special moments of special significance with a special lesson involved.
Well, I have to ask you about a couple of the best-known miracles in the Bible. Do you believe in the virgin birth?
I do.
And the resurrection? Do you believe that what was resurrected was the physical body of Jesus?
Physical body, we should be careful in terms of exactly what you mean by that. Does that mean the cellular structure was exactly the same as it was when he was alive? I don't know, but I believe that he was resurrected in physical form and seen by witnesses who he spoke to before he then ascended. That is the absolute cornerstone of the Christian faith.
But how can you, as a scientist, accept some of these ideas in the Bible, because they cut so directly against the laws of nature?
I have no trouble at all, because again, the big decision is, do you believe in God? If you believe in God, and if God is more than nature, then there's no reason that God could not stage an invasion into the natural world, which to our limited perspective would appear to be a miracle.
Francis Collins talking with Steve Paulson. Collins is the head of the Human Genome Project and the author of the book The Language of God. I might add that one of his favorite pastimes is singing and playing the guitar. After the human genome was mapped, Collins celebrated by rewriting the folk song All the Good People to reflect the genome's promise for curing rare diseases.
It's a book of instructions, a record of history, a medical textbook. It's all these entwined. It's of the people, by the people. It's for the people. It's yours and it's mine.
Is it possible to reinvent a mystery tradition in the age of science? Coming up, the neo-pagans and Wicca.
We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Science versus Religion, is part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Wicca, or neo-paganism, began as a movement to revive or recreate the pre-Christian nature religions of the West, to reject Western culture with its monotheistic male god and its materialist scientific paradigm, and to embrace, instead, the nighttime world of goddesses and nature spirits and mystery. And it turns out to be just what a lot of scientists are looking for. What's the appeal of a mystery religion in today's scientific culture? Anne Strangchamps has more.
A narrow dirt road runs along a valley between steep oak savanna bluffs. Prairie grasses stand motionless under a baking August sun. Near an old white farmhouse, there are people gathering mugwort in preparation for tonight's Green Spirit Harvest Festival. In the converted barn, there are workshops on sacred chanting and herbs to bless the home. This is Circle Sanctuary in Barneveld, Wisconsin, one of the largest pagan and Wiccan communities in the world. If you have any stereotype at all of pagans or Wiccans, the people here today might fit them, like the girl in the orange halter dress with a crown of flowers in her hair, pixie dust on her skin, and a wand in her hand. But ask some of these people what drew them to paganism or witchcraft, and you might be surprised how many are scientists.
I'm a biologist. I teach biology at a university. I think paganism is the perfect scientific religion because it is based on experience and there's no dogma. So it's, in that sense, it's just like science.
I'm a horticulturist. I'm a plant person. Nature spirituality is like the religious or spiritual path for anyone who's interested in working in the biological sciences. I can't imagine how someone who is working with all of the creatures and things that we have around not having some kind of a spiritual connection. Faith and science, it's one and the same, you know. It's one and the same.
I am the IS manager for the U.S. Navy. Magic is any energy that is thrown into the universe. There are ways of harvesting power, just the universe power, to make things happen. I don't believe so much in twitching a finger and having the vacuum cleaner walk across the floor. I do believe that, God, I wish something, and suddenly something happens. Anytime we mess around with energy, we're messing with physics, so I'm sure if we look hard enough, we'll find a theory that will support it.
I'm a returning non-traditional math student. Science and spirituality go well in Wicca. Why do we sweep the circle? Well, it's either to clear a space for the goddess, or it's, you know, you're messing with the positive and negative ions. Like, either way, it proves us right.
Hoof and horn, hoof and horn, all that die shall be reborn. Corn and grain, corn and grain, all that fall shall rise again.
So what exactly is Wicca or modern paganism? What do these people who cast spells and invoke the elements and worship a goddess believe?
Usually in Wicca, there's a goddess and a god. The goddess is represented by the night sky and by the green earth. She's the basic power of the universe. And the god represents the kind of energizing, fertilizing power in the partnership.
Ronald Hutton is a historian at the University of Bristol. He's the preeminent historian of modern pagan witchcraft, and he points out that while Wicca appeals to people who want feminism in their religion, who want a goddess or goddesses as well as a god, there's actually not much theology in Wicca.
In one particular coven, you might have half a dozen people, each one of whom has a totally different private idea of what a goddess or a god is. It's a kind of very modern religion, or very postmodern in that regard.
You don't have to believe in the goddess or in many gods. You can see them as archetypes, you can see them as metaphors, you can see them as real.
Margot Adler is New York bureau chief for NPR, a practicing Wiccan and author of Drawing Down the Moon, a book that's considered the definitive guide to the American pagan movement. Adler still vividly remembers the first Wiccan ritual she ever heard. It arrived in the mail on a cassette tape from two witches in England.
There was this invocation, which is known as the Drawing Down of the Moon. And this invocation was, hear ye the words of, you know, hear ye the words of the Great Mother, who was of old also called, and then it was Artemis, Astarte. And then this woman started speaking as the goddess. And she said, you know, I who am the beauty of the green earth and the white moon among the stars, I call, you know, and it went on and on. It was extremely beautiful. It's what's known as the charge of the goddess. And I sat there and I found I was, you know, tears were rolling down my cheeks because I realized that this woman who was saying this was an adult, and she wasn't in a mental asylum. She was actually a reasonable adult, and she was doing this, and it was okay. There is a longing in the culture for a return to what I would call ecstatic religion without the dogma. In other words, a religious viewpoint where you can dance under a bonfire till midnight or 3 a.m. and get completely ecstatic and yet wake up the next morning and still be a doctor or a computer programmer and not feel that in some way you violated your integrity.
On the other hand, how scientific can a religion be when its practitioners believe in magic? What about the spells, the potions, the oil of myrrh and mandrake root? Surely this is the stuff of superstition, not science.
If you want to get a girlfriend, if you want to get a boyfriend, if you want to find stolen goods, if you want to take a city and make it your own, you want to rule the world, there's a spell for each of those things.
Historian Ronald Hutton.
They're collected in books known by the French word grimoires, and these books first appear in ancient Egypt, and the books are remade in every century until at last we reach the Books of Shadows, which are the magical books of modern Wiccans.
Spellcraft is an important aspect of Wicca, but most bona fide witches caution newbies not to think that just mixing up a bunch of magical ingredients will make the guy down the hall ask you out or get you the apartment of your dreams.
Well, it's very characteristic of the give-it-to-me-quick generation, you know, the generation of instant gratification.
Phyllis Garrott is the high priestess and founder of the Temple of Ara, one of the oldest Wiccan congregations in America.
One of the problems with that is that it actually comes out of an old mindset that we've all grown up with, the idea that the world is a machine and that a spell is sort of the secret of how to make that machine operate with maximum efficiency.
Magic is not really just, you know, waving a Harry Potter wand. It's really very, very simple things. My favorite definition for magic is the art of changing consciousness at will.
That's Starhawk, arguably America's best-known witch, author of The Spiral Dance, one of the founding texts of the neo-pagan movement. Wiccan theologians have developed a fairly subtle and complex epistemology of magic. Some incorporate references to quantum mechanics or chaos theory or string theory. But for most, magic is at heart the practice of coming into relationship with the natural world. It's about developing a deep sense of the interconnectedness of all life, learning to feel the power and energy of the living universe, not just around you, but in you.
Making magic to me is what happens when we've learned to take the blindfold off and discover that the world that we live in is holy, that it's divine and that it's alive, that it's conscious. Spells are really very much like prayers. The difference is that instead of praying to a divinity that is transcendent or removed or outside of yourself and principally male, you're going to the well of your own divine gifts.
Ancient mystery religions were not about secrets. They were about things that could not be talked about.
Margot Adler.
You know, it's like revealing, well, what is the life process about? What is birth? What is death? What is the cycle of life? And that's what the mystery religions are really about. And in some sense, That's what science is about, too. You're wandering through this incredible universe that has a million questions and only a few fixed answers, and they keep on changing. And so maybe there's something very similar to a mystery religion, which explores that process of birth, life, death, and beyond, and so forth, and doing scientific work.
But because it is my native land, I'm my home.
On a hill in the borders area of Scotland, a group of European Wiccans came together this summer, as they have for the past 15 years, for camaraderie and ritual, and to talk one afternoon about this mysterious, magical, and scientific religion they love.
I'll say it's a natural religion. I mean, just that. It follows the laws of physics, the laws of nature. These are natural things. This is the way things are, rather than there's something else out there that's created it or imposed it. So there's no conflict between evolution and the craft, or between the Big Bang, the creation of the universe, and my path. There's no conflict between these. They're simply the same thing.
The spiral of the DNA, the spiral of the galaxies, is our sacred symbol. We don't have to try and fit our lives around a mismatch of some old tribal folklore, silly old rules and badly translated forgeries. Mm-hmm. We write our own sacred texts, and we read the sacred text in the trees and the leaves and the return of the crops the next year. It's laid out before us.
At one time I was a warden of a nature reserve on the Wiltshire Downs. And I would walk over in the morning for 2 or 3 hours recording the animals and plants and things. I was then the scientist, the recording naturalist. Later in the day, I put my notebook down and go back, and I would walk in a dreamy state, feeling the grass and the soil under my feet and feel the land of my ancestors. And if I stand in a wood at night, especially if the moon's coming up through the branches, I sink into the landscape and become part of it, and I feel as though I'm sending out tendrils where I can sense things, you know, and it's all one whole thing with me as part of it.
Let virtue distinguish the brave, life's riches on lowest degree. Think that poorest who can be a slave, and richest who dare to be free.
Our story on Wicca was produced by Anne Strainchamps and Kirill Owen, with help from Margot Adler in Scotland. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Science versus Religion. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, please go to our website at www.ttbook.org/god.
PRI, Public Radio International.